This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books in the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Luke Paulder. He's the founder and operator of memoirghostwriting.com. I hope I got your title right. You know, you're the main person there. And it's nice to have you on the show. How are you, Luke?
Good. Thanks for having me, David.
This is interesting for me because we kind of work in adjacent kinds of territory, you know, where, you know, I'm doing a lot of publishing of books in the hybrid model these days where people are kind of tired of traditional publishing or not willing to go through the exigencies thereof and more interested in some of the professional services that allow a book to be published, but in a different business arrangement. And, you know, you're doing stuff that is similar in some ways. And, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about just what memoirghostwriting.com is. I mean, it obviously, the name of it tells you quite a bit, but I think you kind of want to know more and give some color to that. So maybe you should just talk a little bit about what you do and why you started doing it.
Yeah, so thank you. So every company I've ever started has a terrible name. It's whateverwedo.com, boom, simple enough.
Well, maybe not terrible because in that way, clear as day.
It is pretty unambiguous, so I'll take the win. But there are two things I'd say about memoirghostwriting.com that sit outside of probably what people's expectations are. Obviously, we write a lot of memoirs, but the first thing is I would say about 40% of the people who approach us have actually already written something. It can be as small as a note on their phone. Maybe there are 10 leadership lessons that they've aggregated over the last, say, 30 years. Or it can be a full manuscript. And we meet them where they are. Some people say, you know, it's a full manuscript, but it's dry. It's boring. I don't know what to do with it. And we say, okay, let's developmentally edit it and figure out what's broken and come up with a plan to fix it. Or they say, I have the general outline, but I don't know how to sort of get all the facts and the data and pull the anecdotes and so forth. And we say, great, we'll jump in that fashion. So we do help a lot of people who come to us with something written. The other thing is we do a lot of business books. And sometimes people think, oh, that's sort of strange with the name. The fact of the matter is, unless your last name is Buffett, a good business book is like a third memoir anyway, because you have to establish who the person is, why the reader should listen, what that person wants to say, and perhaps most critically, what the author wants the reader to do next. And so a lot of a great business book, especially for a last name or a name that people are unfamiliar with, has a huge overlap with writing a memoir.
Is your sense that people who are wanting to tell their life stories, let's separate them from the people who have business stories to tell, because I do think those are two different kind of categories of interest, even though, as you said, they're related. You know, what is it that drives people to come to you in the first place?
It's a great question. There are two main buckets, and they fall fairly neatly along the lines of, is the book going to be private or public? So probably about half the work we do has a lot of the same considerations that public-facing books have, right, in terms of the things you're well familiar with, cover design and formatting and all of those things. But we never actually get the ISBN and barcode and we just do private run. Those have one set of reasons. And then something public-facing has a larger array of reasons. And I can talk about sort of four or five main way reasons people might say, okay, I want to tell my story to the public. But on the private front, there are a lot of different reasons, but it often boils down to this idea of legacy. So sometimes people think, you know, well, why would I write about my story, right? That's an egotistical pursuit. And I kind of love hearing that because I get the opportunity to tell people, and I mean this with all of my heart, that what they're really doing, whether it's with us or another firm or one of those fill-in-the-blank books from Amazon, what they're really doing is providing a gift to generations way in the future. And when I say way in the future, I encourage my team to think about how is this going to be read 300 years in the future? I pick that number because it's far off in a way that no one here today is going to be around. And a lot of the context around historical events is also going to have been diluted. So we need to write with the idea that people in the future might not know about the 2008 financial crisis. It might not even be something that appears in their textbook. And so sometimes people say, okay, yeah, but that's kind of hard to wrap my head around. We talk about kids and grandkids, maybe even great grandkids. And I say, cool, we don't have to talk about that at all. Just flip the script and think about exactly what you would have liked your grandfather or great grandfather to have written. And they go, oh, that's the unlock there. They go, I want that book. And I say, great, we can't get all of that for you. We can get whatever you know down on paper, but we can definitely solve that so that those who come after you don't have to feel the same thing you're feeling now about wondering, oh, I would really have liked to know what my great-grandfather was thinking as he came over from Europe on a boat, took 3 weeks, he got to the US, and I don't know what he was feeling. That's the way I help people wrap their head around, why are we doing this? The public reasons can be an element of that, but they're far more numerous, right? So often we're helping position people for for-profit boards or consulting or speaking. With consulting or speaking, it can be either to start it or to scale what they're doing or to scale their rates. For venture capitalists or private equity folks, it can be to increase limited partner interest. And then sometimes people come to us and there's no secondary financial motivation at all. It's not, hey, I want to speak or raise my rates. It's doing what I did for the last 40 years was really painful and challenging. Building a business from zero to 2,000 employees was great overall, but sucked at times. What if I could take everything that I learned and shortcut it for my 22-year-old self? And we see that paradigm quite often where they get in the headspace of, if I could have coffee with me at 22, what would I say? And that applies not only to building a business, but about gender equality, right? Women, for instance, who are in their 70s and say, hey, I would have made different decisions. Let me tell people of the next generation, you know, how they might think about some of the same challenges that I faced. Or it could be navigating the corporate world and so forth. And then that last carve out that I would say is sometimes there are punctuated events and we almost act like, I joke that sometimes we're wildly unlicensed therapists. And what I mean by that is we're not going to provide advice. We're not going to cast judgment. But in helping people find the turning points of a series of events, why they made certain choices, perhaps on a road to recovery, by helping them figure that out in a narrative sense, in a literary sense, sometimes they go, oh, I see that differently now. And so we've done that for a woman who was basically fell off part of a mountain, was left there wondering if she'd ever get rescued. And I have her permission to talk about her book, but the cover of her book is this haunting photo of her headlamp in the distance out of the helicopter window. We've done that for working on one now that I have permission to talk about that involves a shark attack. So a lot of different reasons for public books. But frankly, the private books are some of the most fun because we get to ask everything under the sun and really figure out why people made the decisions that they made.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. I think about, I think that's a good perspective to give, and that is to lengthen the time perspective. You know, sort of reminds me a little bit about Stuart Brand and his concept of the long now, which is different because he's trying to get humanity to think in a longer time frame, like 10,000 years. You're not doing that, but it is really powerful to work on changing the perspective of time in the way you think about things. So I can see how people would find that illuminating to think about their grandparents or their great-grandparents or the generations farther back, or to think about what you would like to read about the 18th century or the 17th century from a firsthand perspective, which is really not so easy to find. So yeah, I think that's really good. I suspect that, as you alluded to, that getting people to think about the narrative, this sort of reminds me about of a class I took in writing fiction, which focused on the way that narrative can work to, it's not solve your problem, but to illuminate the psychological effort of the writer, not so, you know, not necessarily the reader, but it does benefit the writer to solve a problem through telling a story. And I don't think people think about that when they're imagining themselves telling their own story, that it's a way of solving some of the problems in how they think about their past, which is what you just explained.
You're spot on. There is a good amount of comfort in seeing the structure of a story laid out. So I love talking with people in the publishing world because I never have to convince them of the value of an outline. I'm going to add one carve out, but pen should never hit paper before an outline is in place. Now, the carve out there is writing something is better than writing nothing, right? You could fix a page with words.
For a lot of people who don't know where to start, the answer is just start.
Just start.
Because I think some people do get blocked by the notion of the outlining when they're talking about themselves. If they're talking about the story of something exterior, outlining is no problem. They know how to start. But I think a lot of people do have trouble figuring out how to tell a story when it's so close to them, when it's their lives. So I'm guessing that for some people, you have to just say, get a microphone and just start talking into a recording device so that you get used to the idea of telling your own stories.
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways to start. And to your point, voice notes on your phone is great. Writing down anything you come back to in a sort of repetitive way of these are the rules that I live by. But there are also ways to sort of get help from your orbit. So I love asking people's significant others, what are the cocktail party stories you've heard 1,000 times? What are the jokes they tell again and again? And one of the things you do by reaching out with permission, of course, to people's loved ones is you free up the main interviewee to sort of get over this hurdle of talking about themselves. You can say, let us, with everyone's permission, convey to you how you're viewed by those in your orbit. And so we have little sort of clues that we look for in early interviews to say, all right, this person might need a little help singing their own praises. If they give yes, no answers, for instance, or if they constantly sort of reduce the scale or scope of what they've done in life. And that's not to say you need to have done big and grand things, right? This title or that title. We do, you know, a lot of those stories, but that's because when you're in the ambassador to this place or that place, you've got some great stories by default. That being said, I know for a fact, I should say, that we have never embarked on a project where we have not been able to fairly readily find the fascinating bits. And I always think of this one person in particular in her mid-90s. Her son brought her to us. And she said, what about my story is interesting? She said she taught for a couple of years and she raised 5 kids. And I said, ma'am, there is no one who has raised 5 children and does not have fascinating stories, right? She's been on this planet for 90 some odd years. She's seen presidents come and go, disasters happen, people recover in the macro sense, in her own life, and she's raised 5 children. You know, so immediately we go to places that are really familiar. We ask, you know, what did you do for fun on a, you know, Friday afternoon, you know, when you were 7 years old? What did your mother's kitchen smell like? Tell us about your house when you were 4 years old. And these are questions that we all can answer if we sit there and really sort of piece through it. But they're unusual questions to ask on a daily basis. When my team did this with my father, they asked him a lot about smells of his parents' kitchen, his grandparents' kitchen growing up. And, you know, specific dishes came back. And we might not be able to find the exact same recipe, but sometimes we actually can, and we'll put recipes in books and things like that. So we're often going, what I say is that beyond the headlines. So even when someone says, oh yeah, I published a memoir and they were, you know, a former, let's say, senator. I say, yes, you've published a memoir for the public, but you have this whole other side to your life that is of relevance to your great, great, great grandkids. Your professional life is covered. Let's talk about everything beyond the headlines.
Yeah, I think that, I think what you've just sort of suggested is, and I wondered if you would ever consider doing this, is to create a little kit of ideas like that, not necessarily for someone who might want to do a book with you, but just for the average person who might just want to get the stories down of grandma and grandpa or great grandma and grandpa before they go. And that, I love that idea of asking, what did you do when you were 7 years old for fun? Or, you know, maybe similarly, you could tell some, you know, like, can you think of a couple of things that happened when you, before you were 5 years old, that you remember, just to get those early memories out. So people, just to get people talking, it's almost like prompts to get them to tell stories. And I think usually people probably, you'd have trouble stopping them then. They would just keep going. But I think a lot of people would enjoy, and I'm sure that people don't think of that, the idea of smell or taste or sounds. You know, some people are really, have a strong sense of a memory triggered by a smell. Other people, maybe they're triggered by a sound or, you know, by remembering a particular car that your grandfather drove and what it smelled like inside, things like that. I think those are really powerful, and they're individualized memories. You know, it's usually you keep them to yourself. It's rarely do you have the opportunity to tell someone in your family even, oh, I remember my grandfather, you know, he always smoked a cigar. You know, if you can kind of then, of course, nowadays, nobody knows what a cigar smells like. I mean, there's the thing that, and you think about also, you know, just the objects of the past. I think I was, you know, if you think about today, the idea of a dial-up telephone, people, I don't think they've maybe ever used one, you know, a phone with a rotary dial. So you'd have to even, maybe it may be beneficial to have pictures of some of the day-to-day objects that people used in the past that are no longer functional. Even today, think about fax machines were prevalent in everyone's business lives 30 years ago, and now they've disappeared. So it is interesting to think about the material culture as well, because that's all connected to your memory and how you think about, you know, the things that you did on a daily basis are strongly keyed to the physical objects that you were surrounded by.
You're absolutely right. And it's every profession. I mean, when we have the opportunity to interview lawyers who are in their late 80s, how a law firm functions now and how a law firm functioned 50 years ago is dramatically different. And though at face value, someone might say, well, that doesn't sound particularly interesting. You go, oh, but when you talk about what was needed to run a law firm 50 years ago, it's a much higher level of social interaction because you had to collaborate outside of email, outside of e-discovery platforms and all these things that have even had teams of lawyers, you know, become very siloed. So it's remarkable just to look at the things we think we know and then realize we know them from today's perspective.
And you take them for granted. And I think that in terms of conveying the history that you do know, I think it people forget how much of what they used to do is interesting to people who don't have any experience of that today. I just had this conversation the other day with someone about the publishing business and about how social it was and how much time was spent in conversation, in meetings, you know, and this is sort of a famous trope in the publishing business where people used to have 3-hour lunches, you know, the author and the agent or the publisher and the author, you know, a 3-hour lunch talking about the book that they were going to publish and everybody having 3 or 4 martinis. And by the end of lunch, no longer capable of functioning. And of course, that's completely disappeared. But there were other things about work that people did that are interesting to know about, I think, for people that are your descendants or the ones that you're thinking about in the future who may not, even if it's just sort of anthropological, if nothing else, there's a certain amount of information there that could be really valuable to someone studying life ways of the 20th century.
You're spot on. And there's a, I would say that, that exists for regions as well. So there's certain parts of the world where someone says, okay, I grew up mostly here. And I say, oh, there's a great story just about the region. Manhattan is one of them. Bay Area is another. I was speaking with someone this morning who's in Northern Ireland. And if you look at, you know, how Belfast has changed or how Manhattan's changed or San Francisco's changed, it is remarkable how much of the story you can build without ever talking about the individual themselves, right? What is Manhattan like in the late 70s? Well, it's substantially different than now. And so when someone says, I've been on, you know, the Upper West Side for the last 80 years, you go, oh, I have 1,000 questions. And so sometimes, you know, we help people unpack their own life story through basically almost like an anthropological lens or sociological lens at times of how their environment has changed. And, you know, the way that comes up most clearly, I think, is we do a whole bunch of immigration stories. What is it like to come from India to the United States? I can tell you that across all of these stories, there are profound similarities. Doesn't matter where you're coming from. If you're coming from Norway to the States or you're coming from, you know, Papua New Guinea to the States, there are similar aspects of that journey. But notably, there are also profound differences. And we lean on what we know, right? We know that we should always ask, you know, how much money did they have with them when they came to the States? Big thing that people remember. They remember it to the cent. I have heard, you know, $12. I have heard $200. And it's a thing that sticks out to me as, you know, something that every single person always remembers because it's an encapsulation of what the risk felt like. What was your fallback when you came to a country you didn't know with realistically no prospect of returning? And that's a way that they sort of conceptualize it is in one momentary number. But then we immediately dive into the sights, the sound, the hustle, the bustle of wherever they landed. It's often sort of a contrasting thing. Where did they come from? Where did they land? How different are the two? We go into, you know, how did they form their first sort of social networks, their friends? And we often learn about these really robust communities within communities. So you land in New York and you're not a New Yorker first, you're, you know, a Ghanaian in New York or in Queens or in Astoria within Queens in New York. And you start to unpack what does all of that mean? It's really fascinating. It's also just a whole lot of fun to have the opportunity to ask people pretty much anything under the sun. And then the other bucket that comes up all the time is everyone has what we often call these Forrest Gump moments where they don't know how they ended up in the room, but they were in the room. So, you know, they sat next to Muhammad Ali on an airplane and they ended up chatting with him or something like that. And you go, oh, we might not have a natural place for that in your narrative arc, but we don't scrap information, especially if it's for a family. So we might put it in sort of an offset box and say, hey, this is loosely related, but it's too cool to jettison.
Right. You know, there's a book years ago, a publisher in Canada, Coach House Press, did a book called Brushes with Greatness, where they collected stories of just that, those kinds of chance events where people met someone in the elevator or, you know, and I think probably almost everyone has a story like that where they, you know, were present in the room or in a space with someone either famous or of some sort of celebrity, someone important. Those are great stories. And yeah, I'm glad to hear that you can find a home for them. But it sort of reminded me of a question. A lot of this sounds like you do interview work with people as a way of building the narrative. Do you give your client the, let's say the finished product is a book, but do you also give them all and their families, especially when it's a private one, but I imagine even a public facing book, you've got all this material, recordings, you know, maybe you have photographs and maybe you even do video, I don't even know, but you've got all this stuff. Is that part of the deliverable? to your clients so that they have for their families to pass down all the original material?
So it really depends on the person and the family. But in short, whatever they want out of that mix, we certainly provide. Some people want nothing to do with the videos. You know, as they age, they think, I don't want people to remember me as, you know, someone who might have had some trouble walking. And of course, the videos might reflect that they are facing some health issues. We obviously, as sort of a quick aside, we work with a lot of people who are navigating big health challenges, just based on the fact that tons of our clients are in their 90s. And we have lots of ways of going about that. So, you know, we will sometimes do a really macro 6-interview series. And then if they have the energy and stamina, we'll go back and fill in the blanks. And our goal is to not have a health issue exacerbate. And then they're unable to continue. And we have a ton of information about, say, the first 30 years of their life and nothing about the next 60. But to your point about videos, photos, transcripts, we provide everything that they want. It's, you know, at functionally no incremental cost to us to say, hey, we have this body of information. It's raw, but you're welcome to have it. You own it. Photos are a fun one, though, because often people are overwhelmed by the volume of photos they have available and if they're not digitized. So our promise to them is we will always help them come up with a solution. That can mean a whole bunch of things. It can mean we will train them on how to take a B-plus photo with their iPhone, right? So not angling it, reducing glare. It's not going to be an A-plus, right? They're not a professional photographer, but a B-plus across 100 photos can be great. And we can clean them up quite substantially in ways that were functionally impossible a few years ago. Fire damaged and water damaged and yellowed photos. I mean, we can do wonderful things nowadays to clean those things up. But the flip side as well is sometimes people say, you know, I've got all these boxes. It's overwhelming to think about how to go through them. And I say, don't worry about it. We will literally send someone to your house. So we do that quite frequently. What's really great is a lot of times that those requests come out of New York or DC, and I am able to throw wildly overqualified archival talent at that problem. Because in DC, you go, hey, you're a Smithsonian archivist and it's a weekend. Do you want to help go through these boxes and figure out what's important? And you go, a Smithsonian archivist is dramatically overqualified for that in all the right ways. New York's the same deal. In New York, you can find specialty archivists, one that just do X, Y, or Z, and they went to school for, you know, archival work related to Jewish history. And you go, well, that's exactly what we need. Perfect. But we'll also fly people to various places. Or if they have multiple homes, we'll do that. But sometimes, and most often, it's just, you know, how do we help someone decide what's most important? It's not a big intervention like flying someone there. It's, okay, you have 300 photos. Let us shortlist some topics that as you go through this, we think these 10 photos are going to be the most important. And if you can find 8, awesome. And so to your point about, you know, thinking back when they're 7 years old, I always say that there are 4 or 5 photos that we definitively need in each text that we do. So we need a photo of them when they're 2 years old. That's, I say this as a father, but below 2 years old, a lot of babies look the same. So we don't really care about, you know, 6 months, right? So we want 5. 5 is when they really start to look like the person they are, especially if it's one of those cute sort of overall pictures from 80 years ago. We need like an entering college, ending high school type thing. If they were in the military, we need a military photo. We need a wedding photo. And then we need a photo of this is them now. And now can be loosely defined. We have definitely put photos on the back of memoirs where they still have hair and they don't now, and that's fine. But if we go for those 5 or 6 photos, that's a really healthy place to land, and anything above that's a bonus. And we've gone, I think, as high as, 400 photos in a book. Most of the time, people are probably at 35 to 50 is a good place.
Yeah. Well, I think, and a lot of people's lives are really well told in photographs. You know, to your earlier point, the photograph of the summer house in, you know, Martha's Vineyard or something is really evocative. It often includes people, but they, you know, they're really important to the arc of someone's life. You know, and I don't know. I mean, you could, I could imagine someone even telling their entire life story and just in photographs for the most part. And I do think it's good that you help people do that because it's a lot of work. And being a, you know, I know people who are professional photo editors and who work in narrative forms. It's hard. It's really hard.
It is. And it's a body of knowledge that I know enough about to say I shouldn't be involved in the nitty gritty. And what I mean by that is I'm thinking of one gentleman in DC, very organized person. And he said, I have these, you know, 8 boxes or something. But because it was very organized, they were pretty full, folders for everything. And we hired a great photographer in DC. And I could probably only identify half the equipment he brought because there were all these things to, you know, adjust the lighting on site. And obviously we can clean all of that up in the production process, but it's a lot easier to get it mostly right from the outset. And to do that at high volume is a very different pursuit. So this photographer traditionally does weddings. And he said, he was joking at the end of the day, because he and I probably spent 7 or 8 hours on site. And he said, with a wedding, at the end of the day, his lower back hurts. And at the end of this 7 or 8 hours, he said his shoulder and upper back hurt because he was just on their dining room table, boom, 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 boom. And I think we took 2,500 photos that day. Obviously, a lot of them are duplicates, but from that 2,500, we then took them back and collaborated with the writer to say, okay, let's take this down to 400 photos and see what might plausibly be included. And from there, we'll go down to, you know, the final 150. So there's a huge culling of things. But to get photos at high volume like that is not easy. And I quickly realized in hiring many photographers over the years that that you just hire a good person, get out of the way.
Oh, yeah. You need to outsource. There's too many moving parts in what you do. So do you feel like as you talk to people over time, do you have the sense that the generation, there will be a generational shift in the way that people approach telling their own stories? And maybe too early to say, you're a lot younger than I am. So maybe you could think about the future, you know, the people who are your age coming into their later adulthood, are they going to look at this in the same way that your current clients do, who are probably a lot older than, you know, I mean, by far older than you. So you kind of have a range of people to think about. And I'm just curious, you know, I'm not sure there's an answer. I'm not sure you could know, but I'd be interested if you could.
Yeah. So there are two things I'd say. Well, besides that, it's a great question. The first is I think there will always be a place for what we do in the sense that part of the value we provide to individuals and families, it's just making sure it gets done the right way the first time. And obviously there are going to be some bumps in the road, but our promise is always we are going to continue to invest in the project until it is exactly as they want it. Sometimes that means losing money on a project and that's fine. And so sometimes when people are navigating aging or mild cognitive decline, part of the value we bring to the process is just ensuring that we stay on track and get it done. So there are tons of AI options and some of them are fine. And I think those will continue to grow. I think our niche of ensuring it gets done the right way and actually gets done will be around for a long time. That being said, I have had some strange conversations with adult children about their parents when they bring their parents into sort of our sphere and we say, you know, we want to help this family capture their story. And we have it in sort of the back of our minds that someday there will be this weird ethical question around when you have a lot of video of one individual or one person has done, you know, 100 podcasts or in our case, 12 or 14 interviews, you actually have enough to use AI to build an avatar of that person that you can communicate. Ethically, I brought this back to my team and I thought, you know, I've had two people say this to me. They're both tech people in their late 40s, early 50s. And I thought, that is fascinating. I know that I should pause because ethically it feels like there's a lot to unpack there. But it's also fairly inevitable that 20 or 30 years in the future, this idea of a person that never fully passes away will be an option. They're not going to be the real person. You know, I keep talking about the ethics of it because there's a lot to unpack, but there's also the psychology of it. And at some point, I'd love to sit down with a psychologist and think, you know, is it even possible to construct that? Not that we would, that doesn't sit right with me, but to construct an avatar-like representation of a loved one in a way that is psychologically not harmful, right? Because we can think about interacting with someone and almost losing sight of the fact that though it feels like it's not too far from Zoom, it is. They're no longer here, but you can communicate with something that speaks 98% like them. And what's different about now versus a few years ago, of course, obviously, large language models and things have grown in popularity and sophistication. But one of the key things that's changed in that that's relevant to this is the ratio of input to output. It used to be that you needed a lot of data to create something that then you could get a lot out of. There are voice replication tools that now only require like 30 seconds or a minute of input to be able to replicate someone's full voice. Content's a little different, but due to some wildly sophisticated computer science, that ratio has flipped entirely.
And also the base of knowledge of general humanity or human knowledge kind of is already established. So the individuation part, while we think of that as being really complex, is probably less complex than we think. So what you're saying, it seems more and more plausible that it would be very easy at some stage, not today, but soon, to replicate a functioning clone. It might not be physical, but you know, science fiction is not far off. So yeah, I don't know. I haven't thought about the ethics, but the idea of it seems both interesting and disturbing at the same time.
You're exactly right. And I think a lesser, not in scale or sort of ethical quandary, but something that we can wrap our head around is, you know, there are all these apps and things that have come up in the last year of AI girlfriends. And it's basically the same idea, except without the individualization in the same manner. And so all you're really missing to go from that to chatting with a loved one as if they're here is a basket of inputs. And that the size of that basket has shrunk quite a bit. And I'm going to guess will probably continue to shrink. I don't know according to, you know, what scale.
Well, it's almost what you said earlier. You know, five photographs is enough to give you the outline of someone's life visually. I'm not saying in any, but suggestively tells you a lot. So maybe there are some key individuated pieces of information, and certainly you would have it. I mean, a series of interviews asking the right questions would probably fill that out for some use. I'm not going to say that it would be a complex being with human qualities, but it could be replicant. And there then is the argument about, you know, what is being? And being can be defined in a lot of different ways. So yeah, I think the idea of having AI grandpa or AI great grandpa is probably really appealing to a lot of people too, because maybe your great grandchild is too young to really know you. And you might think that's you know, when you were talking earlier, it's like what you're leaving behind for future, the far future that you can't even imagine. That's pretty powerful as a driver to leave yourself behind. It's not a big leap to go from leaving my book or my interviews or my photographs or a video to as much AI self as you can imagine.
I love the way you presented that, because I think we can put into two buckets. Those who, let's assume that there's a data-informed avatar, right? I think I've been looking at it as if the psychological downside risk of that is the same across any relationship that avatar would have, whether it's a loved one or someone they haven't met. And what I got out of what you just said is that there's two different ways to look at it. Let's say someone passes away, a parent passes away, and you have the opportunity to recreate them in digital form, chat with them and so forth. That to me reeks of a really unhealthy relationship, right? Where you sort of try to not process the fact that they're not here and so on and so forth. I'm not a psychologist, but it sounds very challenging. But go forward three generations when that person has never met the person. All of a sudden we've gone in the same way we go from when does grave robbing become archaeology? Well, at a certain point, I can't tell you when, but at a certain point, we look at it like an intellectual pursuit to understand. That is not 50 years after the fact, but if we go back 1,000 years, all of a sudden we can look about Roman ruins and figure out, well, not 1,000 years in that case, but you get the idea. We can look a lot around and try to piece things back together, but it's no longer sad, is my point. It's interesting. It's curiosity.
Well, you could have the contrary view and say, it's fine. The past is the past. We can never know the past. We shouldn't worry about it too much. But then you have the technology that says, but if you want to, there it's there. So maybe that's kind of, it's like everything else. You could say double-edged sword or cost and benefit. You know, you get something, but you also give something up to get it. And, then that'll be a decision that people will have to make. But I have a feeling that, and I had not thought about this, but I think what you've kind of opened up is a really interesting conversation about what do you want to leave behind? You know, how far do you want to go? And maybe that's not where, it's not even close to where we started this conversation. It wasn't what I anticipated, but I think it leaves us with a really interesting, really interesting kind of point to explore further. It's really interesting.
Well, I won't take credit for the following, but I'll give my wife proxy credit. She was an English teacher, and she came across a joke once that says, scientists tell you how you could bring dinosaurs back to life, and the humanities tells you why that might not be a good idea. Everything, exactly. Everything about this had that same debate.
Yeah, it's great. No, I think that's perfect. And the science and the humanist, or scientists and the humanist, will have to have this conversation, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, this was great. I'm really glad we had a chance to talk. It was really fun to hear about your business, but this, where we ended up is even more interesting.
Well, thank you. It's I don't know what the next 5 years will look like for ghostwriting, but I can guarantee you it won't look like today.
I think that's probably true about almost everything that we do. So yeah, we're in for a ride.
Well, makes for good stories.
Absolutely. Well, yes. And that's your business. Good stories. So thank you, Luke. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I've been talking to Luke Palder from memoirghostwriting.com. Thank you very much.